In just a few minutes, President Bush is expected in the White House Rose Garden, where he'll hold a news conference, his first since the end of July. Reporters are likely to focus on different aspects of post-war Iraq. More violence and more deaths were reported there today, the latest in a series of bloody attacks that began on Sunday with the bold multiple rocket attack on the Al-Rashid Hotel in Baghdad. Then yesterday, the first day of Ramadan, four suicide bombs killed at least 34 people and wounded hundreds more in the Iraqi capital. The economy is also likely to be a major issue in this news conference. There have been continued improvements in various economic indicators. Earlier today, the conference board reported an improvement in consumer confidence, but jobless rates remain stubbornly high. With me here in the studio are NPR senior editor Ron Elving and foreign editor Ted Clark, and thanks very much to you both for joining us.
You're welcome.
Good to be here, Neil.
And Ron, let's begin with you. Presidential news conferences, we mentioned this is the first in 3 months, relatively rare in this administration. Why do you think the president has called this one this morning?
Well, this is the 10th full-dress news conference of the presidency, and I think there's no question he's called it this morning to address the perception of the Iraqi policy being in some disarray. I think you can set aside for just one moment the controversy about the policy itself and just address the way people are apprehending the results in Iraq. The president clearly is not getting the spin in the news that he wants to see. The administration would like to see more emphasis on the progress that's been made. And so yesterday, while the president sat there with Ambassador Bremer taking questions about these bombings that you mentioned, he said, the more progress we make on the ground, the more free the Iraqis become, the more electricity is available, the more jobs are available, the more kids are going to school, the more desperate these killers become because they can't stand the thought of a free society. It's very difficult for a speech of that nature to compete with the pictures that were coming out of Iraq yesterday, and so that's why the president has to raise to another level his attempt to put his view of these events forward to our public.
Ted Clark, another attack today. Four people reported killed in a suicide bombing in Fallujah, at least four people. And then we're just getting newswire reports of more explosions heard in Fallujah tonight. We don't know what the results of those are. The situation on the ground, the president is going to have a difficult time presenting his idea of progress as long as this these attacks continue, isn't he?
I think he will have problems. And what the attack today, again, was against a police station. And what I find interesting about these attacks is that they're really quite strategic in their conception. They are the attackers are going after Iraqis who collaborate with the United States, who are training to be police. And the United States is very anxious to turn over more and more of the security burden to Iraqis. So if these attacks result in lower police recruitment or the inability of Iraqi police to function, that will keep the burden on U.S. forces, which are already stretched thin. The other target of these attacks has been international relief organizations. The United Nations pretty much pulled its entire staff out after its headquarters was bombed a few weeks ago. The ICRC, the International Committee of the Red Cross, is reconsidering whether it should keep staff in Baghdad after the bombing yesterday. Again, if these international relief agencies pull out, the burden on American troops to rebuild Iraq becomes that much greater. So far from being seen as signs of desperation, I would say these attacks are really pretty well coordinated and well thought out.
As if to reinforce your first point, Ted, about the Iraqis working with the U.S. administration facing difficulties, news today that on Sunday, in a drive-by shooting, a deputy mayor of Baghdad was apparently assassinated in that city. So, Ron Elving, there are other aspects of the president's policy in Iraq that will be controversial. Amid them, his continuing insistence in the bill before Congress, asking for $87 billion, that the $20 billion for the reconstruction of Iraq be presented as a grant to Iraq rather than a loan.
And that may very well be the best way for the aid to reach the Iraqis and for it to do them the most good. But the political problem that's been presented by some, again, of these perceptions of the situation in Iraq deteriorating is that at home here, Americans are saying, well, we could use a new bridge, we could use a new school. Why are you telling us there's no money for that here? But then we've got $20 billion to simply give to the Iraqi people to build those things in that country. Why can't they pay us back with some of their loan, or excuse me, some some of their oil revenues, which were supposed to be so tremendous and so easily obtained.
I'm Neil Conan in Washington. I've just heard Ron Elving, NPR's senior Washington editor, also with us, NPR's foreign editor, Ted Clark. We're awaiting the arrival of the president in the Rose Garden, where he's expected to be taking reporters' questions. His first news conference in almost 3 months. That's expected to come up in less than 5 minutes' time. And Ted Clark, another issue the president may be asked about is North Korea, the continuing negotiations to end North Korea's nuclear weapons program, and the impending arrival in this country of the highest-ranking defector ever from North Korea, who's going to be describing the horrors of the regime in Pyongyang.
North Korea presents a real dilemma for this administration because the president has said that he personally loathes the leader of North Korea, and yet the administration finds itself in a position of having to engage with North Korea. That it's being pushed in that direction, in fact, by American allies. The other five members of the six-party talks are all requiring or demanding that the United States engage in talks with North Korea. The United States came out with a slight concession a week or two ago, which North Korea immediately dismissed. But now the latest that I've heard from North Korea is that they're willing to perhaps consider it. Reports out of South Korea suggest that the talks might resume by the end of the year. We'll just have to see how that goes. The North Koreans are very skillful. It seems unpredictable to outsiders, but they are very skillful at moving negotiations in their direction.
That latest offer, not a treaty, non-aggression pact with North Korea from the United States, but a written guarantee that the United States would not attack North Korea, perhaps signed by the other four members of the conference, China, Japan, and the Soviet Union, Russia.
Right.
And falling into old habits.
North Korea dismissed it as laughable at first, but yes. Now apparently they're willing to consider it.
Ron Elving, the economy, the jobless recovery continues and continues to be a political problem for the president.
It does, but here again, the president would like very much to be able to get some of the good news out. The good news from the standpoint of the economy today, the conference board reporting that consumer confidence in October was up, and not only up, but up more than expected. They had expected the index number to rise from 77 to 79. It actually rose up a little above 81. That particularly reflects, or at least it's being represented by the conference report as reflecting, a little bit more confidence in the job market, that people are a little bit more confident they can get a job or hold on to their job, and they're a little more willing to spend. There couldn't be better news for the economy.
And on the domestic front, obviously with the presidential caucuses and primaries now scheduled to begin less than 3 months from now, I guess.
January 19th in Iowa.
Then the Democratic candidates' attacks are sharpening, not only on each other, but on the president, and he's going to be hearing more not only about Iraq and the economy, health care, all the set of issues that are going to be coming up.
Yes, particularly on Iraq. This is the new focus, really, of the Democrats' campaign. For months, they were much more inclined to talk about the economy, the jobless recovery, as you said, talking about people having less security. And now, of course, they're increasingly interested in talking about Iraq and the appearance of failure in that theater.
We're expecting the president to emerge in just about a minute to take reporters' questions in the White House Rose Garden. And Ron, the one item of political positive news for the president, he may be asked to talk about this as well, the success of the Republican candidate in California's special election, Governor-elect Arnold Schwarzenegger.
Well, Arnold Schwarzenegger is coming to town this week, unless that gets canceled because of the fires in California. He is not yet governor and not yet responsible for the emergency efforts in his state. Gray Davis is still overseeing that. But Arnold Schwarzenegger is expected to come here and meet with members of Congress, and he's going to have one message, and that is, we need help. The federal government's going to have to pitch in and help California's budget crisis.
And that is going to be a continuing problem. Of course, more states than just California are facing severe budget squeezes and prospect of income tax increases in various places is going to present problems for all sorts of people. Again, our thanks to Ted Clark and Ron Elving for their help as we await the president's arrival. He's just emerged from the Oval Office and striding towards the lectern that has been established in the White House Rose Garden. And now, here's the president of the United States.
Good morning. After the 26,000-mile journey last week, I hope the members of the traveling press had a restful weekend. I have a brief statement, then I'll be glad to take questions. On my trip to Asia, I had a series of very productive meetings with some of America's closest allies in the war on terror. Nations such as Australia, Thailand, Indonesia, and the Philippines are fighting terrorism in their own region. Their leaders understand the importance of our continuing work in Afghanistan and Iraq. Liberating the people of those nations from dictatorial regimes was an essential step in the war on terror. And the world is safer today because Saddam Hussein and the Taliban are gone. We're now working with many nations to make sure Afghanistan and Iraq are never again a source of terror and danger for the rest of the world. Our coalition against terror has been strengthened in recent days by UN Security Council Resolution 1511. This endorses a multinational force in Iraq under U.S. command, encourages other nations to come to the aid of the Iraqi people. Last week, a donor conference in Madrid brought together more than 70 nations to discuss future contributions to Iraqi reconstruction. America appreciates the recent announcements of financial commitments to Iraq offered by many of the donors at the conference. After decades of oppression and brutality in Iraq and Afghanistan, reconstruction is difficult, and freedom still has its enemies in both of those countries. These terrorists are targeting the very success and freedom we're providing to the Iraqi people. Their desperate attacks on innocent civilians will not intimidate us or the brave Iraqis and Afghans who are joining in their own defense and who are moving towards self-government. Coalition forces aided by Afghan and Iraqi police and military are striking the enemy with force and precision. Our coalition is growing in members and growing in strength. Our purpose is clear and certain. Iraq and Afghanistan will be stable and independent nations, and their people will live in freedom. This essential goal in the war on terror requires continued American leadership and the continued support of Congress. The House and the Senate are now considering my supplemental request for operations in Iraq and Afghanistan. Most of this money is for the safety and success of our military, for their pay, for their weapons, ammunition, body armor, vehicles, fuel, and for every other resource they need to carry out their mission. Part of the money is for reconstruction, from the training of Afghan and Iraqi police and military personnel to the building of schools and clinics. These funding requests are just as critical to the overall success in Iraq. I commend the House and the Senate for approving the supplemental request. I urge both houses of Congress to reach agreement soon on a final bill so these vital funds can go quickly to where they are needed. I also ask Congress to move forward on elements of my agenda for growth and jobs. The shocks of the stock market decline, recession, terrorist attack, and corporate scandals, our economy showing signs of broad and gathering strength. America is starting to add new jobs. Retail sales are strong. Business profits are increasing. The stock market has been advancing. Housing construction is surging, and manufacturing production is rising. All of us can be optimistic about the future of the economy, but we cannot be complacent. We'll not be satisfied until every American who's looking for work can find a job. So I propose additional measures to keep the economy on the path to greater job creation, taking action to control the rising cost of health care, protecting businesses from junk lawsuits, by cutting needless and costly government regulations, by making permanent the tax cuts that have helped our economy. One action Congress should take immediately is to pass a comprehensive energy bill, which I proposed more than 2 years ago. Our entire economy depends on steady, affordable supplies of energy. We must encourage conservation, promote efficient technology, modernize our electricity grid, and increase energy production here at home. In the closing months of this year, Congress should also complete the vital work of strengthening and modernizing Medicare. The best way to provide our seniors with modern medicine, including prescription drug coverage and better preventative care, is to give them more choices under Medicare. Seniors have options. Health plans will compete for their business by offering better coverage at affordable price. American seniors are counting on these reforms. I look forward to signing them into law. Finally, the United States Senate must step up to serious constitutional responsibilities. I have nominated many distinguished and highly qualified Americans to fill vacancies on the federal district and circuit courts. Because of a small group of senators is willfully obstructing the process, some of these nominees have been denied up or down votes for months, even years. More than one-third of my nominees for the circuit courts are still awaiting a vote. The needless delays in the system are harming the administration of justice, and they are deeply unfair to the nominees themselves. The Senate Judiciary Committee should give a prompt and fair hearing to every single nominee and send every nomination to the Senate floor for an up or down vote. Finally, of course, we are monitoring the fires in California. FEMA Director Brown is in the state. I express my deep concerns and sympathies for those whose lives have been hurt badly by these fires. The federal government is working closely with the state government to provide the resources necessary to help the brave firefighters do their duty. With that, I'll be glad to answer some questions, starting with Terry Hunt.
Mr. President, you just spoke about the suicide bombers in Iraq as being desperate, but as yesterday's attack showed, they're also increasingly successful and seem to be trying to send a warning to institutions like the police and the Red Cross not to cooperate with the United States. Has the United States been able to identify who's behind this surge of attacks, where they come from, and how to stop them?
I think it's a very interesting point you make in your question. They're trying to send a warning. Basically, what they're trying to do is cause people to run. They want to kill and create chaos. That's the nature of a terrorist. That's what terrorists do. They commit suicide acts against innocent people and then expect people to say, "Well, gosh, we better not try to fight you anymore." We're trying to determine the nature of who these people were, but I will tell you, I would assume that they're either or and probably both Baathists and foreign terrorists. The Baathists try to create chaos and fear because they realize that a free Iraq will deny them the excessive privileges they had under Saddam Hussein. The foreign terrorists are trying to create conditions of fear and retreat because they fear a free and peaceful state in the midst of a part of the world where terror has found recruits, that freedom is exactly what terrorists fear the most. And so as I said yesterday, we will not be intimidated. I said today again that they're not going to intimidate America, and they're not going to intimidate the brave Iraqis who are actively participating in securing the freedom of their country. Steve.
If there are foreign terrorists involved, why aren't Syria and Iran being held accountable?
Yeah. Well, we're working closely with those countries to let them know that we expect them to enforce borders, prevent people from coming across borders, if in fact we catch them doing that. The coalition forces have stepped up border patrol efforts. There are now more Iraqis patrolling the border. We are mindful of the fact that some might want to come into Iraq to attack and to create conditions of fear and chaos, and that's why General Abizaid, in his briefing to me yesterday, talked about the additional troops we have on the borders. And that is why it is important that we step up training for Iraqis, Border Patrol agents, so they can enforce their own borders. John.
Mr. President, thank you. As you know, the chairman of the commission investigating the September 11th attacks wants documents from the White House and said this week that he might have to use subpoena power. You have said there's some national security concerns about turning over some of those documents to people outside of the executive branch. Will you turn them over, or can you at least outline for the American people what you think is a reasonable compromise so that the commission learns what it needs to know and you protect national security if you think it's that important?
It is important for me to protect national security. You're talking about the presidential daily brief. It's important for the writers of the presidential daily brief to feel comfortable that the documents won't ever be politicized and or unnecessarily exposed for public purview. And so therefore, the kind of the first statements out of this administration were very protective of the presidential prerogatives of the past and to protect the right for other presidents, future presidents, to have a good presidential daily brief. Now, having said that, I am. We want to work with Chairman Kaine and Vice Chairman Hamilton, and I believe we can reach a proper accord to protect the integrity of the daily brief process and at the same time allow them a chance to take a look and see what was in the daily briefs that they would like to see. Well, we're working out the procedures. My only point is I do want to be helpful to Chairman Kaine and Lee Hamilton. These are men of integrity. They're people who understand the process. They know the importance of the presidential daily brief. They know the importance of the daily brief to future presidents. And therefore, I think they will be mindful of the need to gather evidence and at the same time protect the capacity for presidents to get unfettered, real, good intelligence. Nora.
Mr. President, if I may take you back to May 1st, when you stood on the USS Lincoln under a huge banner that said mission accomplished. At that time, you declared major combat operations were over, but since that time, there have been over 1,000 wounded, many of them amputees who were recovering at Walter Reed, 217 killed in action since that date. Will you acknowledge now that you were premature in making those remarks?
Nora, I think you ought to look at my speech. I said Iraq's a dangerous place, and we've got hard work to do. There's still more to be done. And we had just come off a very successful military operation. I was there to thank the troops. The mission accomplished sign, of course, was put up by the members of the USS Abraham Lincoln saying that their mission was accomplished. I know it was attributed somehow to some ingenious advance man for my staff. They weren't that ingenious, by the way. But my statement was a clear statement, basically recognizing that this phase of the war for Iraq was over, and there was a lot of dangerous work, and it's proved to be right. It is dangerous in Iraq. It's dangerous in Iraq because there are people who can't stand the thought of a free and peaceful Iraq. It is dangerous in Iraq because there are some who believe that we're soft, that the will of the United States can be shaken by suiciders. And suiciders who are willing to drive up to a Red Cross center, a center of international help and aid and comfort, and just kill. It's the same mentality, by the way, that attacked us on September the 11th, 2001. We'll just destroy innocent life and watch the great United States and their friends and allies, crater in the face of hardship. It's the exact same mentality. And Iraq is a part of the war on terror. I said it's a central front, a new front in the war on terror, and that's exactly what it is. And that's why it's important for us to be tough and strong and diligent. Our strategy in Iraq is to have our strike forces ready and capable to move quickly as we gather actionable intelligence. That's how you deal with terrorists. Remember, these are people that are willing to hide in societies and kill randomly, and therefore the best way to deal with them is to harden targets, harden assets as best as you can. That means blockades and inspection spots. And as you noticed yesterday, one fellow tried to done in as he tried to conduct a suicide mission. In other words, an Iraqi policeman did their job. But as well that we've got to make sure that that not only we harden targets, but that we get actionable intelligence to intercept the missions before they begin. That means more Iraqis involved in the intelligence gathering systems in their country so that they are active participants in securing the country from further harm. Remember, the action in Iraq was to get rid of Saddam Hussein was widely supported by the Iraqi people. And the action, the actions that we're taking to improve their country are supported by the Iraqi people. And it's going to be very important for the Iraqi people to play an active role in fighting off the few who are trying to destroy the hopes of the many. You've heard me say that before. That's just kind of the motto of the terrorists. It's the way they operate. Plant.
Mr. President,
In recent weeks, you and your White House team have made a concerted effort to put a positive spin on progress in Iraq. And at the same time, there's been a much more somber assessment in private, as with Secretary Rumsfeld's memo. And there are people out there who don't believe that the administration is leveling with them about the difficulty and scope of the problem in Iraq.
Yeah, I can't put it any more plainly. Iraq's a dangerous place. That's leveling. It is a dangerous place. What I was saying is there's more than just terrorist attacks that are taking place in Iraq. There's schools opening. There are hospitals opening. The electricity, the capacity to deliver electricity to Iraqi people is back up to pre-war levels. We're nearly 2 million barrels of oil a day being produced for the Iraqi people. I was just saying, we've got to look at the whole picture, that what the terrorists would like is for people to focus only on the conditions which create fear, and that is the death and the toll being taken. Now, Iraq's a dangerous place, Bill, and I can't put it any more bluntly than that. I know it's a dangerous place. And I also know our strategy to route them out, which is to encourage better intelligence and get more Iraqis involved and have our strike teams ready to move, is the right strategy. People are constantly taking a look at the enemy. In other words, one of the hallmarks of this operation in Iraq, as well as Afghanistan, was the flexibility we've given our commanders. You might remember the kind of the stuck-in-the-desert scenario that during the dust storms that we were advancing to Baghdad, and all of a sudden we got stuck. But remember that at that period of time, it was also became apparent that Tommy Franks had the flexibility necessary to adjust based upon, in this case, weather conditions and what he found. And that's exactly what's taking place on a regular basis inside of Iraq. The strategy remains the same. The tactics to respond to, more suiciders driving cars will alter on the ground. More checkpoints, whatever they decide how to harden targets will change. And so we're constantly looking at the enemy and adjusting. And Iraq's dangerous. And it's dangerous because terrorists want us to leave. And we're not leaving. Let's see. Terry, then you, Stretch.
Thank you, sir. Mr. President, your policies on the Middle East seem so far to have produced pretty meager results as the violence between Israelis and Palestinians.
Meager. Oh, okay.
Meager. As the violence between Israelis and Palestinians continues. And as you heard last week from Muslim leaders in Indonesia, your policies are seen as biased towards Israel, and I'd like to ask you about that. The government of Israel continues to build settlements in occupied territories, and it continues to build the security fence, which Palestinians see as stealing their land. You've criticized these moves mildly a couple of times, but you've never taken any concrete action to back up your words on that. Will you?
My policy in the Middle East is pretty clear. We're for a two-state solution. We want there to be a Palestinian state living side by side with Israel. Now, in order to achieve a two-state solution, there needs to be a focused effort by all concerned parties to fight off terror. There are terrorists in the Middle East willing to kill to make sure that that a Palestinian state doesn't emerge. It's essential that there be a focused effort to fight off terror. The Abu Mazen came here at the White House. You were here. You witnessed the press conference. He pledged a focused and concerted effort to fight terror so that we could have a Palestinian state emerge. And he asked for help, which we were willing to provide. Unfortunately, he is no longer in power. He was eased out of power. And I do not see the same commitment to fight terror from the old guard. And therefore, it's going to be very hard to move the peace process forward until there's a focused effort by all parties to assume their responsibilities. You asked about the fence. I have said the fence is a problem to the extent that the fence is an opportunity to make it difficult for a Palestinian state to emerge. There is a difference between security and land acquisition. And we have made our views clear on that issue. I have also spoken to Prime Minister Sharon in the past about settlement activities. And the reason why that we have expressed concern about settlement activities is because we want the conditions for a Palestinian state on the ground to be positive, that when the Palestinians finally get people that are willing to fight off terror, the ground must be right so that a state can emerge, a peaceful state. This administration is prepared to help the Palestinians develop an economy. We're prepared to help the long-suffering Palestinian people. But the long-suffering Palestinian people need leadership that is willing to do what is necessary to enable a Palestinian state to come forth. Stretch.
Thank you, Mr. President. Senior U.S. intelligence officials on the ground in Iraq have estimated that we have at most 6 months to restore order there and quell the violence, or else we risk losing the support of the Iraqi populace, which you've said many times we need to make this mission work. Do you share that sense of pessimism? And if not, why not? And in addition, are you considering the possibility of possibly adding more U.S. troops to the forces already on the ground there to help restore order?
That's a decision by John Abizaid. He makes that. General Abizaid makes the decision as to whether or not he needs more troops. I constantly asked the Secretary of Defense, as well as when I was visiting with General Abizaid, does he have what it takes to do his mission? He told me he does. Secondly, I believe the Iraqi people are appreciative of the reconstruction efforts. The small business owners who are all of a sudden beginning to realize there's a market developing appreciate that. The mothers who send their children to the over 1,500 schools we've refurbished appreciate that. There are going to be new textbooks coming which no longer glorify the tyrant Saddam Hussein but glorify basic education, or at least promote basic education. They will be there. I think the people of Iraq appreciate what is taking place inside the country. And what we, of course, are going to do is implement the strategy, which is encourage Iraqis to help deal with the security issues. And that's what's taking place. We're getting better intelligence, more actionable intelligence, and the Iraqi citizens themselves are willing to fight off these terrorists. If you look at some of the brave actions by the Iraqi police, people who've died for the future of their country, you know what I'm talking about. I mean, there are people willing to sacrifice for the future of their country, the Iraqi citizens willing to sacrifice for the future of their country. Rosen.
Thank you, sir. Perhaps the clearest, strongest message you have ever sent from any podium has been what you like to call the Bush Doctrine. That is to say, if you feed a terrorist, if you clothe a terrorist, if you harbor a terrorist, you are a terrorist. And I'd like to follow up on the Middle East. You have noted that Yasser Arafat is compromised by terror. Condi Rice has said he cavorts with terror. You've both noted that he is an obstacle to peace. He has, in political terms, choked off your last two Palestinian interlocutors. What is it that prevents you from concluding that he is, in fact, under your own definition of what a terrorist is, a terrorist, and should be dealt with in the same way that you've dealt with Saddam Hussein and Charles Taylor?
Yeah. Well, not every action requires military action, Jim. As you notice, for example, in North Korea, we've chosen to put together a multinational strategy to deal with Mr. Kim Jong-il. Not every action requires military action. As a matter of fact, military action is the very last resort for us. And reminder, when you mentioned Saddam Hussein, I just wanted to remind you that the Saddam Hussein military action took place after innumerable United Nations Security Council resolutions were passed. Not one, two, or three, but a lot. And so this nation is very reluctant to use military force. We try to enforce doctrine through peacefully or through alliances or multinational forums. And we will continue to do so. Yeah, Elizabeth.
Thank you, Mr. President. You recently put Condoleezza Rice, your national security advisor, in charge of the management of the administration's Iraq policy. What has effectively changed since she's been in charge? And
yeah.
Second question, can you promise a year from now that you will have reduced the number of troops in Iraq?
The second question is a trick question, so I won't answer it. The first question was Condoleezza Rice. Her job is to coordinate interagency. She's doing a fine job of coordinating interagency. She's doing what, I mean, it shouldn't have, the role of the National Security Advisor is to not only provide good advice to the President, which she does on a regular basis, I value her judgment and her intelligence, but her job is also to deal interagency and to help unstick things that may get stuck. Best way to put it. She's an unsticker. And is she listening? Okay, well, she's doing a fine job. Dana.
Thank you, Mr. President. You have said that you were eager to find out whether somebody in the White House leaked the identity of an undercover CIA agent. Many experts in such investigations say you could find out if there was a leaker in the White House within hours if you asked all staff members to sign affidavits denying involvement. Why not take that step?
Well, the best person to do that, Dana, so that the best group of people to do that so that you believe the answer is the professionals at the Justice Department. And they're moving forward with the investigation. It's a criminal investigation. It is an important investigation. I'd like to know if somebody in my White House did leak sensitive information. As you know, I've been outspoken on leaks, and whether they happen in the White House or happen in the administration or happen on Capitol Hill, they can be very damaging. And so this investigation is ongoing, and by professionals who do this for a living, and I'd like to know. Judy.
Sir, in your last campaign, you said that the American public was not ready for a complete ban on abortion. You're about to sign legislation that will ban a certain abortion procedure known as partial birth. Do you believe that the climate has changed since the last campaign and all abortions should be banned? And do you believe your brother made the correct decision in Florida when he intervened in the case of a woman who had been ordered by the courts to be taken off life support?
Yes, I believe my brother made the right decision. Yes, I'll sign the ban on partial birth abortion. And no, I don't think the culture has changed to the extent that the American people or the Congress would totally ban abortions. Let's see. Mark Smith, a radio man.
Thank you very much, sir, for including our radio folks here.
Face for radio.
I wish I could say that was the first time you told me that, sir.
First time I did it to a national audience, though.
Actually, my wife the last time. Your package of Reconstruction aid, sir, that the Congress, as you point out, is considering, that's an emergency package, meaning it's not budgeted for. Put another way, that means the American taxpayer and future generations of American taxpayers are saddled with that. Why should they be saddled with that? I know you don't want the Iraqis to be saddled with large amounts of debt, but why should future generations of Americans?
Well, first of all, it's a one-time expenditure, as you know. And secondly, because a peaceful and free Iraq is essential to the security, future security of America. First step was to remove Saddam Hussein because he was a threat, a gathering threat, as I think I put it. And secondly, is to make sure that in the aftermath of removing Saddam Hussein, that we have a free and peaceful country in the midst of a very troubled region. It's an historic opportunity. And I will continue to make that case to the American people. It's a chance to secure, have a more secure future for our children. It's essential we get it right. You know, I was struck by the fact when I was in Japan recently that my relations with Prime Minister Koizumi are very close and personal. And I was thinking about what happened if, in the post-World War II era, we hadn't won the peace as well as the war. I mean, would I have had the same relationship with Mr. Koizumi? Would I be able to work closely on crucial relations? I doubt it. I doubt it. In other words, we've got very close alliances now as a result of not only winning a war, but doing the right things in the post-war period. And I believe a free and peaceful Iraq will help affect change in that neighborhood. And that's why I've asked the American people to foot the tab for $20 billion of reconstruction. Others are stepping up as well, $13 billion out of the Madrid conference, which may be just only a beginning. And by the way, in the Madrid conference, most of the money came from the World Bank and the IMF, which are lending institutions, as you know. The Iraqi oil revenues, excess Iraqi oil revenues, coupled with private investment, should make up the difference to fund the estimates of what the World Bank thought was necessary to help that country not particularly since you interrupted me, no. And that's what the World Bank estimated would cost, and it looks like we'll be able to, you know, help the Iraqis get on their feet and have a viable marketplace. Bill Douglas.
In speaking on Abu Mazen, do you feel this administration did everything it could to help him out with his situation?
Yeah, I do.
And secondly, on Iraq, do you feel that the attacks that have happened recently will discourage some countries to contribute troops or manpower?
Good question. I hope not. That's what the terrorists want. They want countries to say, oh, gosh, well, we better not send anybody there because, you know, because somebody might get hurt. That's precisely what they're trying to do. And that's why it's important for this nation and our other coalition partners to stand our ground, to improve our intelligence, to move quickly when we find good intelligence, and to bring people to justice. The terrorists rely on the death of innocent people to create the conditions of fear that therefore will cause people to lose their will. That's their strategy. And it's a pretty clear strategy to me. This country will stay the course. We'll do our job. And it's to our interest that we do our job. It's in our interest we do our job. A free world. A free Iraq is essential to creating conditions of peace. See, that's what this is all about. This is how do we achieve a peaceful tomorrow? How do we do our duty for our children and our grandchildren? We must never forget the lessons of September the 11th. The terrorists will strike, and they will kill innocent life. Not only in front of a Red Cross headquarters, they will strike and kill in America, too. We are at war. I said right after September the 11th, this would be a different kind of war. Sometimes you'd see action, and sometimes you wouldn't. It's a different kind of war than what we're used to. And Iraq is a front on the war on terror, and we will win this particular battle in the war on terror. And it's dangerous, and it's tough. And at the same time that we're confronting the danger, we're also helping rebuild a society. We put in a new currency in place. And for the financial types who are here, you understand how difficult that assignment is, and yet it seems to be going well. It's an achievement that is a very important achievement for the future of Iraq. A stable currency, a new currency, a currency without the picture of the dictator or the tyrant or the torturer, however you want to define him, is important for the future. And that's taking place. There's a market developing. There are women-owned small businesses now beginning to flourish in Iraq. And there's positive things happening in the midst of the danger. And I hope that countries, when they take a look at the situation there, understand the nature of the terrorists and the strategy of the terrorists and don't back off. Tom Hamburger, you got a question? If not, make one up.
Mr. President, tonight you're meeting with Muslim leaders
yes.
at an iftar dinner. And I wondered if you could tell us your reaction when you encountered Muslim leaders in Indonesia? Were you surprised at the hostility they expressed towards the United States and towards your policies, both in the Middle East? And also, I understand that some of them brought up specific comments made by General Boykin.
Yes, he did.
And I wondered if you would address those comments and whether you think that General Boykin ought to be disciplined or resign.
Sure, I appreciate that. First, the characterization of hostility, that just wasn't the case. It was not a hostile meeting, nor did I sense hostility. Quite the contrary, I think the five leaders I met with were appreciative for a chance to express their views. But it was a very positive meeting, very hopeful. The two things that came out of there that I think will interest you, one was that the question was, why do Americans think Muslims are terrorists? That was the kind of the universal question from the three Muslim leaders, and my answer was, that's not what Americans think. Americans think terrorists are evil people who have hijacked a great religion. That's why Mr. Boykin's comments were, or General Boykin's comments don't reflect the administration's comments. And by the way, there's an IG investigation going on inside the Defense Department now about that. But he doesn't reflect my point of view or the view of this administration. Our war is not against the Muslim faith. As a matter of fact, as you mentioned tonight, I was celebrating the iftar dinner with Muslim leaders. We welcome Muslims in our country. In America, we love the fact that that we're a society in which people can pray openly or not pray at all, for that matter. And I made that point to the Muslim leaders. Secondly, the question was about the Middle Eastern policy. Why is your policy so slanted toward Israel, was the question. And I informed them I was the first president ever to have advocated a Palestinian state. I did so at the United Nations. I also informed that in order for a Palestinian state to go forward, as I told Terry, there must be a focused, concerted effort to destroy the terrorist networks who are trying to prevent a Palestinian state from emerging, which requires good, strong, capable leadership, is what it requires. And so those were the two main points that were brought up. There was a concern about General Boykin. It seemed like to me that we've got a challenge to make sure that people in countries like Indonesia understand the nature of the American people, that you know how we think is going to be an important part of good diplomacy in the long run, that we've got to fight off the imagery of a society which condemns entire swaths of people because of the acts of a few. Which is not the way we are. And I was pleased to give the opportunity to make that case to the leaders that were there. It was a very cordial and good discussion. And I'm going to drop them a note thanking them for showing up and giving me a chance to talk about the America I know and love. Bill.
Thank you, Mr. President. After more than a year of being accused by your critics of waging war for oil, is it frustrating to now hear some of those same critics demand that you essentially take that oil in the form of loans instead of grants for reconstruction?
Yeah. Well, that's exactly the point I made to the members of Congress who have come here to the White House to talk about loans or grants. I said, let's don't burden Iraq with loans. And the only thing they'll be able to repay their loans with is oil. And hopefully we'll get a good solution out of the Congress on this issue. We're making progress. We're working hard with the members to make the case that it's very important for us not to saddle Iraq with a bunch of debt early in the emergence of a market-oriented economy, and an economy that has been wrecked by Mr. Saddam Hussein. I mean, he just destroyed their economy and destroyed their infrastructure, destroyed their education system, destroyed their medical system, all to keep himself in power. He was the ultimate. No, he was. That's my answer there, Hillman.
Thank you, Mr. President. You have repeatedly urged Americans to have patience when they view post-war operations in Iraq. But isn't there a limit to American patience, particularly in election year when your foreign policies will be the center of debate?
Well, I think the American people are patient during an election year because they tend to be able to differentiate between, you know, politics and reality. As a matter of fact, the American people are, the electorate's a heck of a lot smarter than most politicians. And, you know, the only thing I know to do is just keep telling people what I think is right for the country and stand on what